Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I really do hope that everyone likes the new website. We've had a lot of changes around here. I'm really excited about the way it looks. We've been hard at work getting it up and ready for everyone. And I'm still trying a few things out, like the new name for the in-between episodes. We were previously Between the Lines, and now I think I want to try out Behind the Page. I think that's a little fun for us. So yeah, it's been a pretty exciting couple of weeks, and it's been a lot of fun though, so I'm not too worried about it. And I think I'm ready to take one last look at last week's read, Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir by Annie West. Now, you might have been able to tell by listening to the episode, but I was pretty blindsided by this book. I can't remember what the reason was, but I was in some kind of mood. Something was actually kind of bothering me, but I guess it wasn't super important since I don't really remember what was bothering me. But when I went to pick out the book, I went in with the sole intention of finding something, well, for lack of a better word, stupid. And that weird title mixed with the really bad Photoshopped cover, it seemed to be the perfect choice. I thought I knew what I was getting into. I thought I was getting in for a wild ride of, oh my gosh, what is even happening right now? And I didn't get that. Yeah, we could say that I missed the mark on that one by a wide margin. There's something strange about the Present series. I think I've talked a little bit about this before, but the way the books are titled, they just lend themselves to parody, honestly. I don't think you could get away with these books anywhere else. Nowhere else would you be able to get away with a title like, let me just check the assortment here for the new group, Beauty in the Billionaire's Bed, or even Claiming His Cinderella Secretary. There's a lot to unpack. It might be a little gauche of me to make the comparison, but I don't think they're too differently titled from, let's say, an adult film. I think there's some overlap. It's just different words are used and not nearly as graphic, but they're still vague. Vague and yet titillating. Yeah, let's go with that word, titillating. Yeah, definitely a lot to unpack. And there's something else, too. Don't think that I have not noticed the racial makeup of a lot of these books. Harlequin in general is already pretty white. There are a couple of exceptions. I'll come out with that one right now. There are a few exceptions, but it's pretty white. It is cookie cutter Starbucks girl with her Ugg boots white, and that's okay. But then you've got the Present series with let's say a Mediterranean theme. The other books in the Harlequin lineups are not as egregious. There's, in the Present series, you see a lot more of this. There's, like I said, there's a Mediterranean theme. Greeks are a big mention. Saudi Arabian heroes as well are pretty popular, I would say. And I think what makes it really interesting is that the titles have to lay it all out for you. We have to know that it's a billionaire Greek, not just a billionaire Greek, or a Middle Eastern prince, like a sheikh, is it sheikh? I think sheikh. It's very, very interesting. And like I said, the books kind of lean towards very Caucasian audience and subjects, I guess you'd say. And I'm wondering what this says about the demographic. I'm not sure what it says. It's certainly an interesting statement, whatever it is. I'm not sure how to feel about that notion. I did find a book that really stood out to me. We'll get to this one a little bit later, but I really did notice the homogeny, I guess you could say, really early on. And I'm already seeing a lot of trends in the Harlequin mainstream romance genre. Mainly that the guys are all white, if not Mediterranean, toast and marshmallow, I guess. And there's hardly any ever mixing as far as I could tell. So I did find a book that really stood out to me because it does not do this, but I'm going to put a lid on that because that'll be a little bit later on. We'll get to that one a little bit later on. It's very interesting and I have high hopes for it, but I don't want to say too much more about that now. But let's go ahead and get back to Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir. When I was looking into this book, I pretty much expected that I was going to get somewhat a similar experience to the one that I got with Crown Prince's Bought Bride. That book was pretty much a solid meh for me, so I didn't really have hopes for His Majesty's Heir. And honestly, the sincerity in this new book really surprised me. I would have expected this kind of story, maybe not heartwarming. I don't know if heartwarming is the right word. It probably needed a little bit more familial angst, maybe. There was some of that, but is gentle the right description? It was calm in a way that I don't think Bought Bride was. Because Bought Bride, they're like, there was like, you know, crazy stakes. Like they had to get married and she had to like come to terms with the fact that it was just a political arrangement, even though she's got nothing to offer him politically. With Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir, I felt like Aurelie was really, really well aware of who she was and what position she held in society. And both she and Lucien were extremely grounded in whatever that they were looking at. Like, they knew their positions. And it was really kind of up to the both of them to really help support each other, to show each other what the other one had to offer. And the sincerity in the book actually did let me wave my hands a little bit more for my suspension of disbelief at the wilder parts of the story. Well, minus the taking the stranger home with you, even though you don't know his name and he's probably drunk or really out of sorts. That, I can't let that one go. But you know, a random woman walked in from the street after getting off a tour bus, got into the palace, and pretty much demanded an audience with the king right then and there. And they're like, okay, what could go wrong? Yeah, that one's a little bit crazy. But I really liked how we saw Aurelie interact with not just Lucien, but also the press and other people in his world. They took a lot of actually good time to explain and show to us that while she had trepidations, Aurelie was finding it a little bit easier to melt into Lucien's world than she might have thought. And as far as sincerity goes, I really do think Lucien could have done a much better job of reassuring Aurelie that he really did love her. It's obvious to us. It's obvious to the readers, which can be a little bit frustrating. Like, if you know if you know the characters are going to be together at the end, if you know that one of them is truly in love with the other and the other one feels the exact same way, but they don't communicate this, it's frustrating as a reader. I think that a lot of people kind of enjoy the drama going, oh, how will they ever come back together? But it's kind of formulaic for me at this point. There's always some kind of separation near the third act. I want to see this happen a few more times before I declare the trope. I'm not sure what to call that trope yet. I think that's why I want to wait on it. So we're going to have to see how we find that one more and more. And speaking of tropes, we have a new one, The Spark of Something. I already knew that this was a thing in romance novels long before I ever started this project. Forgive me my sin, Twilight is infamous for this. I once saw Bella described as a pair of pants that the reader could basically put on and inject themselves into that situation. Because obviously the lead male is in love with the heroine protagonist. And these books are, they're pretty much written for white heterosexual women. And so if we don't see too much of the heroine in the story, it's really easy for the reader to kind of slip into that role. And it's ambiguous as to why the hero has fallen madly in love with them. And I do think that it's a feature, not a bug, but it can come at the expense of mismatched character development. But if the reasons for love are ambiguous, the reader can go, oh, well, I'm like this too. You know, kind of the way people put on horoscopes. It's like, you know, you read any horoscope about yourself somewhere and you're like, oh, that describes me, but they kind of describe a little bit of a lot of people. And it's gonna hit, usually. And this is also kind of exacerbated by the fact that the romance in these books happens in an extremely short time period, and we need to really believe that the couple are in love by the end of the story. And Harlequin books don't have a lot of space for that. They sit between 50 to 80,000 words on average. I actually kind of looked this up earlier. I was curious. In the realms that I'm familiar in, namely long-form fantasy, romance can take numerous books to resolve or, heck, even acknowledge. There, one series that I really quite enjoy, it's not until the third book that the main character even starts thinking about people that she likes. My dog just sneezed. So now we've got Spark of Something, that authorial wand that makes her characters completely in love with each other. And if it's handled deftly, we can allow it in our minds. I think Annie West did an excellent job with the romance. She was showing us that her characters, she was showing them that they were in love, and not just because she said that they were in love. Looking back with Bob Wright, I didn't really get that feeling. I just got two people who existed in the same space for more than 24 hours, and by the time they were married, they weren't even in an actual stable relationship. It was just convenience for the both of them. I don't really find that attractive. Our other characters, they took their time. It was like 3 weeks that they were able to spend with each other. And that time just allowed them to become more and more in love and enamored with each other. I want to see more heroines with agency. And I was pretty proud of Aurelie. She wasn't really going to let anybody walk over her. I especially love the scene when she got the attention of the press and she's like, you know what? I'm not going to hide out. I am just going to go ahead and I am going to go out, and I don't care what anyone thinks about doing. I don't care. And I was actually really proud of Princess Ilsa as well. I was pleasantly surprised that she didn't turn into the catty other woman who was like, wait, no, this was my man. I saw him first. Like, that's not what the situation was, but I could very easily see it playing out that way. And I'm really glad that the book didn't. I really hope to see her again so that she gets her happy ending. The book did give her a little fun fling that the tabloids were salivating over, and it actually helped to take the heat off our main couple. But, you know, she deserves happiness as well. She was quite an engaging character, and I hope that she gets happiness. A little bit more on tropes in general. I've been thinking on mine for a little bit. So we all know about TV tropes, that website black hole that will trap a reader in for hours. They probably have hundreds upon hundreds of every conceivable romantic trope hidden away, waiting only to be uncovered by an unsuspecting browser. And I am staying as far away from that website as I possibly can. I don't want to look at it. I don't want to think about it. I just kind of want to avoid any TV trope stuff in general, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to be as organic as I possibly can. I want to see what stands out to me over time. Eventually, I'm probably going to want to start making a database of all of these tropes that I'm naming, that they can be organized so readers and listeners can find books based on the themes that I've noticed and made note of. And I don't want to be influenced by those other databases. This is all just for fun. It's not really terribly scholarly. It's not a super serious endeavor in this podcast. I am just an escaped English major having some fun. And speaking of fun, let's look into what I am currently reading. As promised, I have finally gotten around to Cinderella is Dead by Kaylin Byron. This book is a twist on the Cinderella fairy tale, but it takes place long after Cinderella is dead. I think it's about 200 years. Sophia Grimmins, oh, I see what you did there, Miss Author. She is a young woman living in basically a dictatorship, the kingdom in which Cinderella found her quote-unquote happy ending. Like any good young adult fantasy based on a fairy tale, it is not straightforward at all. You've got unreliable narratives, fanatic worship of a legend thought to be true, and a desperate need to change one's life for the better. And of particular interest for me is that Sophie is a queer woman of color, a combination I really haven't seen a lot of, but I do want to see more of, which is why I'm seeking out books like Cinderella is Dead. I want to take the time to find out these stories that I just haven't been exposed to. The peril of Sophie's situation is that when young women come of age in her kingdom, they are forced to attend a ball in the finest of dresses that their families can afford, in the hopes that they will be chosen by a man to be married, much like Cinderella had been chosen by Prince Charming. There's a little bit of myth that kind of surrounds this ball. It's very interesting. For starters, they almost pray to the Cinderella story. Like, it's almost, if they pray hard enough, a fairy godmother will come and bless them the way one had blessed Cinderella. And unfortunately, if you don't get the blessing of said fairy godmother, not like many or any of them do, it can probably end kind of badly. The real big danger is that the girls only get maybe one or two chances to go to this ball and find their happy ending. And if they fail after that, they are never seen again. Men can come to the ball as often or as late as they'd like, but who cares, right? But this, as you might surmise, is a problem if you are a lesbian desperately in love with your childhood best friend. Sophie spends a good portion of the beginning of the story really trying to convince her her crush, her young love, Erin, to run away with her. Sophie is very, very headstrong. She only lasts a couple minutes at the ball before completely losing it. And, you know, same. I wouldn't put up with it. But it can be, there's a little bit of a balance that I think can struggle. Is like you desperately want to break out of the chains that society is binding you into. But this is basically a dictatorship. It's, forgive the analogy, I just kept thinking, like, this is what happens if, like, in North Korea worship Cinderella or something. Because Sophia's family is in danger. The people around her are in danger. A person who the king accused of helping Sophia escape the ball pretty much gets murdered in the street very publicly by the prince himself. There's a lot at stake here. I'm not finished with the book all the way yet. Right now, Sophia had run off from the ball and she meets a girl who claims to be the descendant of one of the evil stepsisters. And then together they are off to go on an adventure to try to find the original fabled fairy godmother. So that's kind of where we are right now. It's all right, I think, so far. Like Sword in the Stars, though, the book has an axe to grind. There's a lot of anger in it. But that just might be a reflection on how young adult readers are experiencing the world right now. Everything, well, kind of sucks. And it sucks more for the teenagers because they're aware that everything sucks, but literally can't do anything about it. And it probably feels a lot worse for the kids in the marginalized communities, like the queer and folks of color. So they turn to books and media that might feature characters who are probably just as angry as they are, but they got more agency to do something about the world in which they are living. They have an actual chance to change their circumstances. And young adults and teenagers probably see these and they find some comfort with this. I might just be talking nonsense, but that's my initial take. I'll have to see how the book ends. The author does have another book out called This Poison Heart, and I think I might have to put it on my to-read list. It looks very interesting. So I think that will be it for today, everyone. Be sure to join us next week when we discuss The Negotiator by Melinda DiLorenzo. And thank you so much for joining me today. If you like the show, you can visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. And if you want to say hi or have any questions about the show, you can email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster, and our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.